Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's February 13, 2012, and this is episode 322. And it's actually not February 13th, but I'm going to be releasing this on that date. And I'm here towards the end of January with a very old friend on the MVP communities, and someone that I know that most of you already know and are going to really enjoy the conversation with today, and that's Landon Michelson. Hi, Landon.
Hello.
Hey. We were just talking before we started recording that it's been 6 years since you joined the I'm trying to think of a good way to put it, but it's like You kind of graced us with your presence of good 6 years ago now, and you've been a very active member of the forum and the community since then, and you've added so much. So it's great to be talking with you today.
And I've enjoyed my stay over the last 6 years, so I don't plan on going anywhere soon.
That's good. But we've spoke a couple of times. I'm sure that people that have been listening for a while have. I've heard you on the podcast before. We've done the round tables, and it's certainly not the first time we're hearing you, but it's great to be sitting here, and I'm looking forward to, you know what, I wish there wasn't a time zone difference, because it's your evening now, but it's the middle of my morning, and if we were both in the evening time zone, I'd have a beer and just sit here and like chatting with an old friend. So
yeah,
let's see.
Someday we'll do that in person. So
absolutely, I can't wait. So Landon, tell us how and when you got into photography.
Okay, that was a few weeks ago. I got into photography in my early teens. I purchased a Pentax ME Super from a local camera store in the mall, and I started shooting some things. I recall paying about $99 for that one, and it was worth quite a bit more a couple years later. I guess I got a good deal on it when it came out. And I really liked the camera, and I started to try to learn photography with it, and it was pretty much, manual, old cat's eye manual focus. And I really liked it. I had fun with it. I ended up with more accessories for it as the years grew. I had some junk lenses for it in comparison to today. But I had fun with it, and I tried to use a library of resources, reading magazines, anything I could find that didn't cost much. I shot, film frames sparingly, and the time it took to take the photo, see the results, and recall what and why I had shot something were too many days apart, sometimes too many weeks apart, and so the learning curve just felt incredibly tall.
Yeah,
and it was really hard to pick up on my mistakes and not repeat them the next time. So I managed to capture a few keepers. I made some enlargements worth framing and sharing, but I had so much to learn. And my favorite film back then was Ektar 25, and I loved to use it for moving water shots. But I just never really excelled at anything because I was trying to learn everything.
Well, I mean, I know that you're a bit of a perfectionist as well, so I can imagine that it was frustrating. The amazing things with digital is that instant feedback that we get. So it's certainly but in the film days, you'd forget. I went through a phase where I used to write down the frame number and then the shutter speed and the aperture and things like that. But even that though became so laborious. It's just, it was necessary to try and, especially when you're experimenting, to try and sort of learn from what you're doing. But now it's all in the EXIF and we can see the image on the back of the camera and everything. It makes the learning curve so much shallower, or less steep.
Yeah, and you can learn from your mistakes immediately. Whereas before, you'd try to write it down, you'd try to remember it, and you'd come back weeks later and you couldn't even remember why you shot it.
Right.
Let alone what you were thinking.
Right.
So it was different.
Yeah, it's things have certainly changed. So let's see. I know that you have a day job as well. Can you explain a little bit about what you do in your day job and how that ties into your photographic life?
Certainly, I probably have kind of a unique situation. my day job is part of my photographic life. So I don't separate the two as far as my photographic endeavors. Just one feeds off the other. So I have a full-time career. My title is lead multimedia designer. And I'm basically also the staff photographer. So I get to make a lot of photos. I edit a lot of photos. I use a lot of photos. I create projects with photos in them. I do packaging design, websites, brochures, magazines, books, sales and marketing materials, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
I go on location shoots, aerial shoots, product photography, portraits, advertising shoots, you name it.
Got it.
So I use Lightroom, Photoshop, Illustrator, InDesign, and the rest of the master collection of the Creative Suite all year long. You know, I never have the same day twice, and I really like it because I get bored with repetitive work. So this is the most exciting career I've ever had, and I have no plans to change things. I've been there doing basically the same job essentially for 11 years. Yeah. It's just the responsibilities have gotten more as the years progress. Yeah. But I've never gotten bored with it. So it's part of my photographic life during the day, and then you know the stuff that I do on the side is under my total control. So. I don't know. For me, it's like the best of both worlds.
It is. I mean, I know we've spoken about this before, and it sounds. I mean, it's kind of unfair to even say that your day job isn't a photographer because it is such a major part of your work. So, I mean, I know that you it's not the main. You know, you're not really a full-time photographer as such, but it's so much a part of that of your working life that you may as well be. And I mean, you're probably doing more photography in your job at the moment than I am since I quit my day job. Because I've been writing the book, I've been doing, you know, there's lots of things that I've been into over this last year, and I don't get to shoot as much as I was hoping I would be able to when I quit the day job. You know, just trying to market things and get the business off the ground has been quite intense. So I'm sure that even though it's not a photography position as such, you're probably doing more photography in your day job than I am now as a full-time professional. So it's I can imagine how fulfilling that must be for you.
Well, you know, there's not a week that goes by that I don't shoot something, and usually I'm shooting something every day.
Yeah.
You know, But if I'm not shooting something, I'm editing a photo or using a photo or doing a layout with photos. So it's just part of the job.
Yeah, that was actually one of the good things about writing the printing book that we released last week, which and that was it's going to be 3 weeks ago by the time we air this. But I did a lot of photographing things like just in the studio here and just like photographing the process of creating the. Gallery wraps and things, and so it was really nice for me to actually be doing a project at home where I had to do lots of different photography to make it work. So and that's one of the things that you're doing all the time, only you obviously get out into the field a lot more as well, so it's great. I mean, I kind of envy the job that you've got and the life that you have there. It sounds like the perfect mix of you know, a professional. I was going to say trade, but you know, not so much trade, but you know, professional sort of environment where you've got so much photography in there that it keeps you, you know, probably keeps you on your toes, you know, from the graphic design perspective, but also from the you know, the visual perspective, and then you've probably got a lot of input into your photographic life right there, so. Sounds great.
Yeah, and then like I said, one feeds off the other. So as I improve on my side business, that increases my abilities in the day job, and as I increase in my day job, it spins off. You know, so I don't know. It's kind of like a mutual symbiotic relationship between the two, and they don't get in the way of each other. They feed on each other. So
yeah, excellent.
And so, and then I get to, you know, it pays well enough too. I get to stay in the valley I want to live in. So I didn't have to move.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So you also, I remember you telling us a while ago that you also used to have a videography business. Can you tell us about that and if it sort of, if you feel as though it played a part in making you what you are as a photographer as well?
Yeah, that was about four careers ago. So
four careers ago. Okay.
I started right out of high school doing graphic design and had my own company. not long after high school. And I was managing a hardware store when I had the opportunity to put my toe into the video business. I was introduced to it by training an existing company how to use computers for video titling and graphics. It did not take long to just get folded into the company for that role. And at the time, I wanted to go to school to become a 3D animation artist. But the good schools were expensive, and the computer-to-student ratio was low, and I worried I was only going to learn a lot of theory instead of hands-on, because I learned best hands-on, actually, by doing. I don't read a book and understand how to do everything. I just got to sit down and do it.
Yeah.
So the best school, arguably, at the time was the Vancouver Film School. So it was not only out of state, it was out of the country. So tuition was really expensive. So I had to make a decision while I was in college where I was going to go. I ended up just getting a loan at the local bank. I purchased my first computer. I got some software, and I just got to learning. Then I got another one, and I kept growing. And next thing I knew, I was part of something bigger. And before the business came to an end, I owned 51% of a U.S. government-qualified product, part owner of two other ventures, and still had my own sole proprietorship all at the same time. It was crazy. And I gave it all 110%. Even though it didn't always pay very well. And then it ended 8 years after it started. When it did end, it was a huge release, you know, for me to be creative doing something else.
Wow. So, yeah, I mean, that sounds like, you know, you gained a lot of business experience there as well. And
that was my school of hard knocks.
It sounds like it, yeah.
I learned more in that 8 years than I could ever share in a book.
Wow. Yeah. I'm sure you did. It sounds as though you really sort of you had a lot of experience pummeled into you at that point. So
yeah.
So with the
advent, plus I was young and dumb, didn't know any better. I had to learn it all myself.
So with the advent of DSLRs, you know, a lot of photographers are trying to find their feet in videography as well. So You came at this from the opposite direction with your earlier videography experience. So do you feel that background helps your photography in any way?
Well, it is an interesting question. I came to video with no prior knowledge of how to do video. You know, I started shooting out of necessity for the business, and then learned to edit the video by reading the basics and how to, you know, what editing was, how to do it, you know, cuts versus dissolves, all that kind of stuff. But I really learned how to edit by editing my own footage. And then I learned how to shoot by having to, edit what I shot. So one fed off the other. And I learned in post-production pretty quickly what I needed to shoot to have what I needed in post, and then what I needed to do in post to make my video work. So it was long to figure out, you know, what I needed to do.
Yeah.
And I merged the computer graphics into the mix pretty soon, and I could take a script and turn it into a finished product, you know, after, you know, a couple of years of just hands-on doing it. And it was a lot of work in those days.
I'm sure.
Large format tapes, big video cameras and decks, everything was analog, and editing was just starting to become computerized. And you're working in a client, you learn pretty quickly how to give them what they want and then give them what they need. Because sometimes what they ask for and what they end up needing and getting is not always the same thing. So, and for me, video was an interesting medium. It was always about the motion and the story. So photography was on the back burner in those days. To this day, they're two different approaches for me. You know, I find it difficult to do both of them well at the same time. The other at a time, and I can pretty much excel at doing, you know, video if I'm doing video, or photography, but if I'm doing photography, but both at the same time is harder to pull off, I find. It's just two different brain spaces.
Yeah. You
know, I'm either concentrating on capturing stills of motion or movement and telling a story visually with video. So it's hard for me to do both at the same time. Plus logistically it's hard.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. You need a whole different set of gear for. I found, when I started to do some DSLR video, I bought a nice 5-series Jitsu tripod and put a Manfrotto fluid head on it. And to this day, I mean, the idea at the time was that I would be able to use that tripod if I thought I was going to be doing some video. But I found that, you know, the thing is just so heavy. I only take it out if I'm going out to shoot video. And so it's
just video.
And it is. I mean, you have to go out with the idea that you're going to shoot a video. And I mean, the only exception is that I do sometimes shoot what I call moving stills, which is, you know, I'll drop them into a slideshow every so often or something like that. But it's, you look at it, it's basically framed like a photograph, but it's a 15-second clip. And so the blades of grass will be blowing in the wind, or the snow will be, you know, driving across the screen, across the frame, something like that. But they're literally, there's no panning involved or anything like that. So you don't need the fluid head and things. So it's really, to me, although I'll shoot the odd video clip, generally, if I'm going to shoot video, it's a totally different thing. So I'm you know, fully in line with what you're saying there.
Well, and usually when you're shooting video, you're working from some type of storyboard or script, right, or idea of what you're going to do with it in the end. So just grabbing clips randomly, you know, you don't even know what you're doing with them, and other than just to grab them. But
right,
well, you know, the only connection I feel where video really helped me with photography is that when I learned to shoot video, it was pretty much all manual. I was used to the setup times and things done, you know, to do things right with video. You know, heavy tripods, heavy quick release plates, heavy batteries, big cameras, big video decks, big tapes. It was a lot of work compared to the options we have today. And the audio was just as much work as the video. You know, I think the work I did with the equipment allowed me to feel free once I started doing photography seriously, because it was such a subset of gear. And you could do photography by yourself. And it's very, you know, rare that you can do a video production by, let alone a movie, you know.
Yeah.
It requires a pool of talent to do that. Got you. Photography is typically a one-man band, so.
Yeah. So the only sort of short movie type of things that I've done them on my own, but I think that there's certainly a limit. The thing that's coming to mind is the first time I went out with the tripod I was talking about earlier and the new setup, and I did a short movie called Meguro River Sakura, the cherry blossom. And at that time, what I did was, you reminded me of it as what you said a few moments ago. I didn't write anything down, I didn't storyboard it as such, but I decided that I wanted to do something where it had got a build up and a story and then an end. And so what I did was I started to shoot footage as I approached the area where the people were going to be, to looking at the cherry blossom. And so I got a shot with the cars and the buses going down the street, but you could see people in the very distance, you know, far distance, crowding around something. And then I walked a few more paces, you know, towards it, and got some more footage. And then so I'm building up, you know, I mean, it certainly wasn't a Star Wars production, but I was building up the tension to make people say, okay, so I can see people looking at something, but what is it that they're looking at? And then capturing a few scenes like that, I panned around from a crowd that are all looking over a bridge on the river, panned around to where you can actually start to see the cherry blossom. And then so you go, oh, I see, it's cherry blossom time. And so, you know, I consciously made a decision to make it a story. And then I captured various scenes throughout the day. And then I initially didn't think about this. I didn't think I'd be out that long. But it got dark as I was photographing the various things. It got dark. And so at the end, I managed to get all of the lanterns and along the side of the river and people walking home. I purposefully, instead of photographing from an angle where people were walking towards the camera, I photographed them or videoed them walking away from the camera. So they're going home now. It's got dark. They're on the way home, and it was a good end. So I ended up with a build up, an introduction to the whole thing, then lots of footage in the middle, and then the final sort of ending. And I thought it worked really well for what it was. But so I mean, you just reminded me of it, because that sort of thing is totally different to the one frames, or even if you're doing a photography project, you know, you're still capturing single, you know, sort of best hit sort of things as you go through and build that up into a project sometimes. But it is a very different way of thinking.
Yeah, and even if you're shooting a story to go in a book for photos, it's different in video because, you know, there's in video, you usually have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm.
You know, you've got points where, you know, your interest needs to peak, and where you're doing, you know, establishing shots, close-ups, tight shots, details, you know, how you're doing your movement of your camera, the movement of the scene, mm. you know, the movement of the subject matter, all mm. that stuff it's different.
Yeah. So how much videography do you at the moment, how much videography do you do with your DSLRs?
You know, in the dead of winter, not a whole lot, but I do a fair amount of video with the body, the video body now, but purely out of desire to explore the medium.
Mm.
You know, I really hate the look of camcorder video. Yeah. You know, I understand the value of it for the YouTube believability crowd. You know that if it's not shot with a flip cam, they don't believe it. You know, I understand that, but it just drives me nuts to have camcorder video.
Mm.
I just don't feel control of, you know, how the image looks. And yeah, you know, I like to extend photography with moving video, but I don't like packing in another camera into the field to do it. So unless I'm dedicating to go out and shoot video, I'm not taking video gear.
Mm.
You know, I would prefer to have video in the body and then just shoot video clips as I need them for my personal, you know, gain.
Yeah.
You know, so having 1080p video with you at all times is nice.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, and then macro video is my new hobby. So for me, that's something I could never do with video.
Yeah, it was just not possible. So
yeah, and now you just, you know, it's almost too simple. I mean, there's some gotchas. You know, you got, you know, camera shake is magnified 100 times.
Yeah,
but it's fun.
Yeah. So what sort of subjects are you doing macro with it? Like bugs or flowers? You know, what sort of subjects are you choosing for that?
You know, bugs and flowers are the easiest ones to go for because they're interesting. You know, I've been trying to figure out how to capture some macro snowflakes,
uh-huh,
you know,
nice.
on video. But this winter has been so crazy with weather that, you know, I get nice snow one day and then it melts the next day, and then 70 mile an hour wind gusts, and then it melts, and then it's like, oh goodness. So yeah. it's been hard to plan for anything, but it's fun just to explore.
Got you.
You know, I got a little bit of video gear too, just to make sure that I had it in my kit. I can record clean audio, I can record clean video. If I need to do an interview, if I need to do a product demonstration, you know, I have the tools to set up and do it and make a really nice, you know, clip for a client.
Mm.
And we've got some on the schedule. It's just a matter of when, you know, it's like hurry up and wait in some of these projects. So it's just nice to have it in the kit and have it available. You know, I do use it for myself, you know, like when I go shoot a wedding.
Yeah.
I'll have it available, and I'll shoot video clips of the dance and the parts of the storytelling that are in motion. I don't ever promise the client they're going to get any of that stuff because it doesn't always, the venue or the client or the lighting or whatnot isn't always cinematic.
Mm.
But it's nice to have it and come back in post and see if I want to make something out of it. And it's always nice to have it for myself, if, you know, to make my own marketing videos with too. So.
Mm. So what sort of gear do you use for that? I mean, you're saying about getting clean audio and stuff. What sort of gear do you use for your video?
Well, for video shoots where I'm actually doing something for a client, you know, for real, I usually rent the gear.
Mm.
I usually rent what I need for shoots, as owning a lot of video gear and not using it does not pay very well.
Right.
So, and video gear is, if you think photography is expensive, video is even more expensive.
Yeah.
So for events, it is tougher because you usually have long format, you know, clips, so you can't use a digital SLR,
mm.
you know. So like stage performances, you know, you might have 2 hours to record. So today I still use a Canon HP40, a little mini DV, and I hate tape, but I don't know. I just don't want to invest in a whole lot of video gear that's going to get outdated.
Yeah.
So I just rent what I need, And I use digital SLR video for short format work, like personal projects, you know, interviews, clips destined for cutting down and mixing anyway.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing. And I have a little Zoom H1.
I use that
for audio. Then I also have a Link Juice box. So I have my XLR mics. I can plug into that. It has a preamp. It's got phantom power. So I can take pro-level mics, plug those into that, and then bring the stereo into either a video camera or the H1, you know, depending on how I want to bring that audio in. And the H1 is awesome. I mean, I've audio quality I've got from that thing is just astounding for what it is. And then it's portable, too. So if I need to mic somebody, I just put a lapel mic on them, put the H1 in their pocket, and then sync it later with Pluralize. So it just makes life simpler. I don't have to worry about radio mics. I don't have to worry about radio frequencies. I don't have to worry about, you know, any of that stuff.
Yeah. I've got a Zoom. I think it was the H4 I got. So I can't remember, but they're great little devices, and they're relatively inexpensive as well.
Yeah.
So what about photo gear? What sort of gear do you use? And I know that you're I want to say Nikon, but I know that the people over there are going to, it's Nikon.
So it's spelled the same.
It's spelled the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you use?
After I had my Pentax ME Super for a while, I ended up with a second one, then I ended up with two winders for it. And then I just started to outgrow it eventually. And I really needed something that was more of a workhorse. So I asked a pro photographer friend of mine at the time. I said, what would you recommend I buy? And he says, you go get a Canon A2E. I said, okay. So I got a Canon A2E, a nice little, you know, L zoom lens for it. And I started shooting with that thing, and I never felt in control of that camera. It just felt foreign to me every time I shot with it. It didn't matter how many rolls I shot through it, how often I did. It was just something about it that it just didn't fit.
Well, the zoom rings all go the wrong way and everything, right?
And the lens mounts backwards, and you know, it's just, it was a cool camera. I think it was technologically, it was a little before its time, you know, with the eye controlled focus and eye controlled depth of field, you know, and stuff. It was cool. I don't know. Maybe it just wasn't the right time for me, but I sold that camera, traded it for a lens before I thought it would become valueless. So, my bodies now are, I have four Nikon digital SLR bodies. And each one of them has its benefits and its shortcomings. I have yet to find a perfect body that does everything, and I'm sure as you have the same case.
Yeah, they're keeping that one as a marketing technique.
I know. I would love to just have one or two bodies that do everything.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we're getting there, but I'm still curious, like these other people, how many more digital SLRs I'm really going to buy. You know, I might end up with one and have other cameras too. So I don't know. But today I have a infrared converted D200. I have which is a crop body. I have a D300 that I use for remote event placement and backup, and that's a crop body. Then I have a D700 full frame, which is my portrait and event workhorse. You know, that's my go-to thing for everything that's serious.
Yeah.
And then I have a brand new D5100 as my travel camera. So that's got 1080p video. It's got the LCD that articulates. So each camera body has a vertical grip. I've got lots of batteries, lots of chargers. And then I rent gear and lenses as I need it for other shoots. So if I need like a D3X, if I need 24 megapixels, I'll just go rent the camera for the weekend and then return it. And that money that I don't have to invest in an $8,000 body means that I don't have to try to make enough money with it to afford it. So,
And that
works for me.
Yeah. So you mentioned that, you know, you're probably not going to buy, or you wonder how many more DSLRs you're going to buy. Is that sort of talking like something like the conversation that Trey Ratcliffe
kind
raised? So the mirrorless bodies and things like that. Is that what you're thinking?
Well, for two reasons. One is that I don't see all the new innovation happening on the bodies. It seems like, you know, you get one or two new features, but all, you know, the 10 new features are on other bodies. But I'm going to own a digital SLR for a long time. I just wonder how many new ones I'm going to buy. I don't think I'm going to buy four new ones.
Yeah,
I just don't know. The innovation's happening. on some of these other form factors, but you know, I'm looking at the higher end stuff, like what to do maybe with medium format, where that's going to go, how the price is going to come down, how that's going to approach the market. What I, you know, for maybe more in depth commercial work, what I might end up with for serious video gear, you know, cinema lenses, if I'm going to step into more of that type of thing, and so kind of in that middle area that may or may not have a whole bunch of them. I don't know, but I mean, I'm enjoying them today, and I have big hands and I like how they feel. Like, you know, I hold a little camera for very long and my hands start to cramp up.
Yeah. And that's how I feel. I mean, that I think that they're certainly going to change, but until a few, maybe even just a few months ago, I don't think that I would have contemplated getting something, you know, one of the, like the Micro Four Thirds or things like that. But if the, you know, the sensors get big enough to give us some nice bokeh, then it's certainly going to be an option. But I don't really need a smaller body as such. It'd be nice to get like smaller gear, less weight. But at the same time, I still want something to get my hands around. And so it's I don't necessarily want something that's really small unless it's ergonomically right as well. But I think, I mean, you mentioned also there about the medium format. I think that we're getting to a point where, you know, cramming more pixels onto a full size 35 millimeter camera sensor is probably not going to be the best thing to do. And even like Canon's announced the 1DX, which is that's taken a drop in megapixels over the current flagships. So I think that they're realizing that quality pixels is more important than the number of them. But I also think that there is something there with the medium format. And I was actually, I mean, I don't know if this was the alcohol talking, but I was with a bunch of guys from Pentax last night, and they have told me that they're going to set me up with a 645D, is it? The D comes after or before. One of their medium format cameras to take to Hokkaido with us. I don't know if it's going to come to fruition or not, you know, and this will be aired after or the day that I leave. So by the time people hear this, I'll probably have, you know, figured all of this out. But if they can give us some gear to try out up there, then I'm going to be really happy about that. Cause I think that obviously the frame rate is probably going to be a factor for like flying birds and things like that. I want my 10 frames per second there, but or even five. But I think for some of the fine artwork, like the crane studies and things that I do, I would love to do those with like 40 megapixels. And because, you know, I mean, although people say that it's not about the megapixels, it is about the megapixels. I mean, I've got some images that people still buy prints of today that I shot with my D30, and that was a 3 megapixel camera, but I can't sell them any larger than at a push A3. And even last week I sold a couple of images to a company in the Netherlands, and they're going to put them on a 4 to 5 meter wall. They're going to have basically use a new process where it's not wallpaper, it's like a plastic or a perspex sort of stuff, and it's printed in segments and then applied to a wall. And the original, I sent them, when they first asked about this, I sent them a light box from Photo Shelter, and it included, they wanted some of my flowerscapes, and it included a couple of images that were shot with my 5D at 12 megapixels. And although they bought two photos, one of them was from my 5D, and it turns out that it didn't have enough megapixels to do the job. And so if that person had not been interested in me as a photographer, the Martin Bailey brand as such, then they would have just gone to someone else and bought something similar. But instead, I mean, luckily, because they're interested in me, they said, okay, so let's look at alternatives. What else do you have that is shot at 21 megapixels, because that's what we need to do this job. And so, you know, if I had stayed with my 5D, I wouldn't have made a sale last week. And so, you know, there's always going to be a time when the pixels do matter. But like we said earlier, you know, it's also coming to a point where the camera manufacturers also know that it needs to be quality pixels rather than the number of them. But they still can't drop below a certain amount now, because people are getting used to, and there's technology springing up that make use of 20 megapixels. So I think that we can't backpedal too far either.
No, we need to take where we're at as a threshold and a foundation and move forward. But we don't want to give up signal to noise ratio. We don't want to give up dynamic range. We don't want to give up, you know, the megapixels we have. We want what we have to become better and more usable and more feature filled, and make it not necessarily easier to take a photo, but easier to gain control of taking that photo.
Don't you?
We don't want to regress.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but I'm kind of excited about some of these new third generation cameras, because if I want to do something like, you know, get an 8-blade helicopter unit and stick a Micro Four Thirds in it and go shoot video and stills with it, the payload is so much lower.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's so much easier to do that rather than trying to get a really expensive helicopter to hold a digital SLR. So
right.
You know, it's just, I guess it's the right tool for the right job, but we just have more options nowadays.
Yeah. It's exciting. I mean, they're good times. I think that we'll probably, for me at the moment, what I really want to see is just, I mean, like the Sony, I forget the name, the number of the body I'm thinking about. There's a Sony Alpha out now that has that the like semi-transparent prism thing there, and or mirror, and so they basically you know, they're able to do 12 frames per second, I think it is, which is beating the 1DX. But it's a relatively inexpensive body now. And so, you know, that removing the mirror but keeping the form factor of the current DSLR is interesting as well. I mean, I'd like to see more of that, because then, of course, you've still got something to get your hands around and all of that. So,
yeah, my full-frame D700 has a loud mirror. Mm. And if I'm in the middle of a ceremony at a church for a wedding, you know, it's pretty noticeable.
Yeah.
So I actually like the little D5100 because it has a quiet shutter mode.
Mm,
yeah. So I can be a little more sneaky with the photos and people don't look at me as much.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of nice having options, but I just wish the options were in more than, you know, four bodies. I wish they were all more of them available in just one or two. But
yeah, got you.
Well, time will tell.
Yeah. So, you know, I feel as though I'm a bit of a control freak. I take, you know, I generally try to take a lot of pride in what I do and do things as well as I can. But you kind of take it to extremes. Where do you think your attention to detail came from?
Yeah, I guess I am a perfectionist. I'll admit it. But I don't like mediocrity.
Hmm.
So, you know, and the common saying is that I hear a lot is, oh, that's good enough.
Yeah.
It just rubs me raw.
Yeah.
I just, you know, my to my core, that just bothers me. And I don't know where it came from. I don't know how it was instilled in me. I don't know if I just developed it over time. But if it deserves to be done at all, it deserves to be done right. And if I don't have time to do it twice, I certainly don't have time, you know. If I don't have time to do it once, I certainly don't have time to do it twice. So I just have the work ethic to just try to do the best job I can with what I have available.
Mm.
And that doesn't mean that I'm going to spend 23 hours to make a photo.
Mm.
If the photo warrants it and that's what I need to do, that's okay. Mm. But I guess I just gravitated to producing the best I can out of any given situation.
Mm.
So I take a lot of exposures, but I only share the best stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm often, I have to be my own critic. So I don't have a whole lot of other people to sit next to me and go, oh, that's a great one. Oh, that one's terrible. You know, don't ever share that one.
Mm.
So I kind of have to develop my own critique, you know, internally and figure out what is really, you know, good and what's not.
Yeah.
And oftentimes you have to do that pretty quickly, because if you're doing it for a living, you know, you're getting paid for it. You can't sit there for 3 weeks trying to figure out which shot's the best. And I went to a workshop last week or 2 weeks ago, and one of the things we talked about was how experts in the field, like, you know, people that look at art forgeries,
mm.
the more they study the piece, the less likely they are to judge it correctly. So usually with their trained eye, their first gut reaction is right.
Yeah.
And as soon as they start overthinking it, their chances of getting it right are dwindle. So I think that some of that comes into play on my end too, is, you know, I want to get the bad stuff out of the way. I want to bring the best stuff to the top and only look at that stuff and then go from there. So I don't know. You know, it's an interesting part to me that, you know, through the quality I have to become known for. I guess I'm a technical artist, maybe. I don't know what you'd call it, but I have to be kind of careful because I don't want to be technically proficient, be technically perfect, and then lose the artistic quality or lose some, you know, value to the photo that was more aesthetic. So it's always a balance. It's always that right brain, left brain thing. It doesn't mean I have to shoot everything with the world's best equipment available either. You know, it just means that I will do the best I can with what I have available.
Yeah.
So I actually embrace flaws. I like making mistakes. It doesn't bother me. Yeah. But I like mistakes because I'm in control of fixing them.
Right. You learn by your mistakes, as they say.
And I don't mind learning from other people's mistakes too. But sometimes I have to make my, you know, my own.
Yeah.
You know, a case in point is I love to shoot into strong sunlight, but I also like to control the flare. So even though I'm shooting into the sun or other light to get a look I want, I'm also bracketing that flare and controlling it and holding up a flare board so that I have a shot with and without it. And, you know, in the post, I'm not stuck with how the lens flared. You know, I have, you know, total control over how I use it. And then sometimes I change my mind and say, no, I did like it better without the flare. But I guess for me, it's, I don't need the best lens on earth to make a photo. I just have to know what my limitations are, and I have to know how to make the most out of any given situation. So I like to have the best I can afford and do the best job I can and move on and be better tomorrow than I am today.
Yeah, excellent. So how do you learn and grow in your photography now?
Well, as many photographers, I absorb a lot of information online now. I mean, it's just so much stuff out there. You got forums, podcasts, you know, you get videos, you got different shows, you got blogs, online training, you name it. There's so many resources now. I'm a member of PPA, you know, Professional Photographers of America. I'm a member of American Marketing Association for a year, see, you know, what I can learn there. I read through some magazines each month. I'm past president of our local photography club, and currently I'm the training coordinator and on the board. And I love teaching others. It also forces you to know your subject that much better, because when you have to teach it to someone else, it forces you to internalize it more and internalize it different. So if you're just practicing it, it's one thing, but when you have to teach it to somebody else, it helps you reinforce your own knowledge. Plus, as you know, you learn a lot by interacting with other photographers. You know, I'm immersed in photography daily, as we talked about, and I try to think about shooting scenarios even if I don't have a camera on me. So even if I'm not making a photo, I'm always thinking photos. So my mind is always going. My family also encourages me but I also try to keep all that in balance. You know, I have a day job. So I have also mentored other photographers for years. Some, you know, on a question and answer basis, some on a workflow assistance basis, some with just feedback, some giving critique and offering advice, and a few on a more personal friendship level. Of share and honesty and feedback, open dialogue, even, you know, to the point of building a site together and sharing photos and stuff off, you know, in a private session, you know, and actually mentoring somebody through their business, through their photography, through their workflow, through their editing, you know, giving honest feedback. And all that makes me a better photographer.
Sure.
Because it reinforces right. how I would approach it. But right. I'm always careful not to push my agenda on somebody else.
Yeah. Go on.
Because of how the world sees photography, how the community is growing, how they shoot, you know, photography, and then how I do it, and then try to coalesce all that into some type of scope of analysis, so I can, you know, I can give them some real world education and help.
Yeah. It's true. You know, the teaching others is one of the best ways to become better, good at doing what you're doing. I mean, obviously you've got to get to a certain level before you can try to teach others. But once you're at that level, you learn so much from I mean, my photography has improved so much since starting the podcast, even, you know, just because it put me through. I started to think about things in a lot more structured fashion, and I don't know how much of it was going to be organic and happen anyway, but I've certainly saw my photography improve over the first few years, and well, each year, hopefully, as I've been doing this. But yeah, teaching others is an amazing way to learn yourself as well.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is, you know, too anal to admit, but I'm even cautious about or top of mind about when I'm taking a photo is, if I share this photo, I'm going to have to explain what's in that EXIF data.
Right.
You know, so I'm even thinking that, you know, like I've chose this setting for a reason, and I'm even explaining it to myself as I'm shooting it. Yeah, this is what I want. Well, this is why I shot it.
Right. That's exactly that's exactly what I mean with the, you know, I found myself very quickly after starting the podcast. Every shoot that I do, I know that it could be, it's a potential subject for a podcast, and I was starting to. I'd be selecting certain settings, and I'd be saying to myself, "Okay, so when you talk about this, what are you going to say about why you chose that particular shutter speed or that particular aperture or why did you frame it this way and things like that?" And it started to build into like a mental checklist that I went through as I was shooting, and it not only gave me better material for podcasts, it gave me better images. So yeah, totally in line with what you're saying there.
Yeah, I just have to make sure that I don't overthink the technical, but allow the creative to take into aspect too. Because I am, you know, I'm left and right brain at the same time, if you know, if you can call it that.
Yeah.
You know, because I have the technical side and the artistic side, so I do try to combine the two as much as possible. You know, I know my way around a shutter speed, and I know what aperture to choose, but also I don't want to get so caught up in the technical that I lose focus on, oh, yeah, that sun moved and I'm not taking advantage of it.
Yeah, well, I think that the thing is even these questions that I ask myself, it's all split second stuff. And
yeah,
it doesn't, once you've got the technical, it kind of becomes backstage. But these things that I'm saying now as well, they're all split second decisions. So I don't think it slows you down as much, but it slows you down enough to make you think about what you're doing.
But so. I'm sure you've been out shooting with, you know, people that are completely technical, and they sit there and they look at, you know, the markings on the panning base, and and they're worried about the setting, and then do they have it for completely level, and then you know, all these settings, and then, well, you know, the moment was 3 minutes ago.
Right. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think in others I have seen that, and I'd probably be lying if I'd said that I've never missed a shot through thinking to something, or maybe, you know, you're setting up. I mean, one of the worst things is when you see, say you're driving along, or you're driving to somewhere that you wanted to, you arrive at your planned destination. And say, as you're getting out the car, and you can see some mist on the top of the river or the pond and that, and you're walking over there, you're setting up your tripod, you're getting your cameras loaded on top of the tripod, and just as you get ready to take the shot, the mist disappears or something like that.
Yeah,
I mean, those sort of things certainly happen.
Well, you know, and you know, I guess over time I tend to gravitate towards capturing what I saw as quickly as possible, and then setting up and technically getting the shot that I'm going to print.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if it's something like that, you'd probably, unless it's almost, you know, there's no way you could get it handheld, it's still worth grabbing one or two shots as you're setting up. But it then, you know, if it looks as though it's going to last long enough, then you can take a little bit more time then. But yeah, I mean, it's the technical can get in the way. And I, like you say, I mean, I have seen people that spend so much time trying to make sure that everything's perfect, the moment's gone. So,
yeah. Well, now that everything's set up and everything's perfect, do you want to wait for tomorrow the light to come back?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the trick is with that as well. I mean, is that obviously I know that you do this as well as me, but you know, get to the place. I mean, the example that I just gave was probably more of an opportunistic sort of example, but 9 times out of 10, the majority of the time, we'll be at a place well before what we think is going to happen is going to happen. So, you know, you're all set up and waiting for things to happen, and it's more a case of a waiting game, as to hoping that something happens, hoping that that mist arrives. Because usually mist on ponds and things is usually something that happens just around dawn as the temperature starts to, say the difference between the temperature of the water and the air is different, and it all happens at a certain time, and so if you can read that, you just make sure you're there beforehand.
And in some parts of the world, it happens every morning, and other parts of the world, you see it twice a year.
Right, right. So yeah, I mean, these things are good planning and everything as well is pretty important. So. You do all of this work in your day job and as your for your own photography, but even on top of that, you've got a bit of a moonlighting job as well, haven't you? So tell us about that.
Yeah, I do profit from some of my work, so I don't just shoot on the side just because I like to. I try to do that as often as possible, but I also make an income from it. So, but I am focused now in three local markets. I do weddings. Only about 4 or 5 a year. I don't like shooting them every weekend. I don't want to get burned out. I know my limitations. I put a lot of time and effort into a wedding. I love the storytelling, but I love high school seniors because they're different. They're creative. They're fun. They're unique. Every shoot's different. Every client's different. Every location we go to is different. So I just find it is a great place to explore, creative options for, each new client. And then I do commercial work.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my three prongs of where I make an income.
Yeah.
And then I love to shoot other stuff too, but often I get to flex my creative juices, with these different shoots. And I'm a boutique studio. I take my entire studio on location as need be. Yeah. I don't advertise beyond the web and word of mouth. And each year I get great referrals, great clients, and I rarely have to turn away less desirable jobs. Every once in a while you get the call and it's like, nah, it's not for me. Because I just don't get cold calls. So most everything's referral and network, and it works well for me. Wow. Nice. I enjoy the challenges of commercial work, such as industrial, real estate, product photography, as well as tapping into local needs for licensing images for magazines, visitor guide covers, local publications, that type of thing. So that's kind of my three focuses. Yeah. That doesn't mean I won't do the occasional family portrait. Doesn't mean I won't do the occasional newborn session. That's just not where my focus is. So
got you. Wow. So it's all good. It's nice though. I mean, referrals feel good, and it's the more work you do, the more people are out there to be your proponents. So it's good stuff.
Yeah, I don't want to hang a shingle up on the local street and go into business doing this. I just enjoy doing great work for great clients. So, as long as that can sustain itself and I don't have to do it every day, I'm happy.
Yeah, well, that's why it's the best kept secret, right?
Yeah, well, a client of mine coined that term years ago and said, "You're like the town's best kept secret," and I'm like, that name stuck. So that's why it's always been that way.
So you know what, Landon? We're coming up on an hour, and what I think we're going to do is split this into two parts. So at the end of this first part, let's give people somewhere to visit you. Where can people find you online?
If you just go to bksecret.com, you'll find pointers to all my information, social, and everything. So that's the easiest place to find me.
Excellent. And your new, I don't know how new it is, but your new website is looking great. Congratulations on that.
It's like the plumber that's got the leaky toilet. And I've been trying to spend time on my own sites, and it's hard because I'm always working on other people's stuff. So yeah. It's a work in progress. It's never done. It's only launched.
Yeah. Well, it's looking great.
Thanks. I wanted my new sites to say, "I'm a photographer."
Yeah, and they do.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah. Okay, so really, thanks, Landon. We'll be back. We'll be back for another episode with you next week. But for now, thanks very much for your time, and speak to you again soon.
And thank you for your time.
You're welcome. So thanks very much for listening today. You can find everything that I'm into over at martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look there if you're interested. And I'll be back next week with another episode. But in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you do. Bye-bye.